We have a natural immune system to this, but it's weakened. And you know, it's very odd because I don't usually speak about this in this way before people who I don't know, quite frankly. Many of you I know and many of you I don't know. But there must be some need for you all to hear this. So hear it well. There are things in the world that seemingly have no explanation, but they do. But we don't have enough knowledge of the other side. We don't have enough knowledge of the way things really work. And now what can we do? Well, our mental attitudes are important. Our positivity, our lightness is important, not just to make us happy. Our ability to resist, let's say, darkness, depression, is important. What we do affects many, not just us. That's why I said before, warner of coming dangers, we have to stay awake. We who know have no excuse. I remember Pir Vilayat once saying to me privately, and then he went and, thank God, said it to everybody, but it freaked me out for a few weeks. He said, "You know, Shahabuddin, when you die, you're going to have to face Murshid one-on-one. And he's going to ask you, did you do the work? Did you spread the message? Did you bring healing? Did you bring awakening?" And you know, Pir Vilayat, he had the look in his eyes. And he said, "And you will not be able to turn your head." I have not forgotten. And it wasn't something that was like, you're going to go to hell or anything like that, but it was worse because he was saying, you are going to have to face someone you love. Not some authority figure. You're going to have to face someone you love, and they're going to look through you and ask you. And what did it really mean? And fortunately, I went and I did meditation. I said, well, I better go deeper. It really means facing the mirror of our soul, our own soul. Because our own soul is all love. God is love. So we have to face whatever that love is. And it asks us, you had the opportunity. Did you do it? Did you do it? Anyone who doesn't fear death is a fool. Not fear going to hell or any of these things. We'll talk about that in a minute. But if you don't fear that moment, you are a fool. St. Paul said, I die daily, remember? He still feared death. Went through it every day. He said, I still fear death. I know it and I fear it. Not the activity. The activity, really, I can help you prepare for. But the awakening. When the body is released, when you give back this physicality, you know, this huge energy is released. That is what the unprepared mind perceives as the light at the end of the tunnel. It is the visualization of that release. But for you who will be prepared, you'll be able to use that energy immediately. You will not see the light at the end of the tunnel. You will be it. Did you say alhamdulillah? Yeah. I'm with you. I agree.
Can't you see it and then merge with it?
No. The light at the end of the tunnel is still a representation on the level of mind. The real activity occurs at the level of heart, the real mind. There is no other at that moment. You have already merged with it. Because we are not capable of experiencing that, we externalize it as the light at the end of the tunnel being the memory. Life. You go to the end of memory, you see the light. But you will experience the light itself immediately. You will be that. If you study the prophets and the mystics, this is what they were saying in a coded way, but they were saying it. Ramakrishna said, when I die, my consciousness will become a million points of light. Maybe he said 5 million or something. You know, which, if you know Ramakrishna, whatever it was too small a figure. But the same with you. When you die, your consciousness can become this immediate luminosity, this incredible amount of energy is released as you go consciously. You know, I did not see this, so I can't say that I witnessed this, but I want to tell you about something that I know was true because I felt it. I was in Darjeeling with Katharneta and with a very dear friend of ours, a great Tibetan painter named Jamyang Singe, and who was a monk, and he gave that up and became one of the three last Kargil Tanka painters in the world. Now his teachers died. There are two who know how to do it the old way. Incredible paintings. His stuff is in the Asian Art Museum. And so we went to visit Singe's parents in Darjeeling in India. And he said, I want to show you something. And he took us to this little house in Darjeeling. It was a one-room hut. And it was open in the front, so there were three walls, and the whole side wall, like the longer wall, was open to the elements. And the energy was so beautiful. It was so incredible. I said, what happened here? You know, what is this? This is like a temple. And he said there was a great lama that lived in this hut, and he died a month ago. And he died sitting up. He called everybody in and he said, I'm going to die tomorrow. And he went into meditation the next day and everybody was sitting around. And he stayed in meditation and he died. And he stayed in meditation for another 24 hours after his physical death. He told them, don't move my body until it falls over. He stayed in meditation for 24 hours. No pulse, no life signs whatsoever. He was physically dead. And this rainbow, and they all told me this, this rainbow appeared first around him and around the house and stayed there until his body fell over. And what was it? Well, that was that energy, that incredible energy that's so available. If you've ever been at a birth, you know that the energy of birth is unique. You never experience anything like that again. Well, the energy around a conscious death is equally unique. There is no other experience that is like it. You know, there are certain unique experiences. Sexual orgasm is a unique experience. We say other things are orgasmic or like it, but they're really not. There's nothing like that. There are these gifts given to human beings. One of the great gifts is the energy of death and its transformation. Now, the beauty of dying consciously is that you are not pulled back. You are free to leave. Now, we'll take a break in a few minutes. Can you sit for just a few minutes? This is not a good point to break. What is the role of the friends and relatives who are present here on the earth, not even present at the death? When you hear about the death, it is our duty. It is our duty to joyously pray for the happiness of that soul that's leaving. We think somehow that's immoral. We think, well, I have to grieve. There'll be plenty of time for grief. Of course you grieve your loss. But the initial reaction to the trained spiritual person must be what you said, Alhamdulillah. How wonderful. Their journey begins. And those of you who know the universal worship, and I know some of you know it well, there is a service in the universal worship for a funeral service. And in that service, there is this sermon that was written by Inayat Khan, and he said, whatever you do, don't change the words of this sermon. It's two paragraphs long. And how does it begin? Mourn not. Mourn not for the death of the beloved. And then he goes on to say, you don't understand what they're experiencing. If you knew how the sick are cured, how the burdened hearts are released, you would not mourn for them at all. Your destiny still keeps you here on the earth. Theirs is letting them be free. Let them be free. And it goes on and on and on. I don't have it here because I can't get online. I was trying to, but my computer, it was Catherine Ada's computer, it's all in Chinese. So I had trouble. If anybody has a notebook or a way to get online, I'll print this out for you if I can. See, in two paragraphs, it says it all. It's password only. It's password protected. You can? But I can't give you the password. I'm sworn to. Are you a Chirag? Yeah, you know you're not. Okay, that'll work. We'll pass it out. We'll have our own secret. I like secrets, you know. You can bring the burial sermon and bring the prayers too, the special prayers, because everybody should have those. This is not secret, of course. You can share this with anyone you wish. It's just getting onto the site. It's protected, and we all promised we would not do that. And so,
is there a website for some of the other parts of the universal worship?
Yes, but ask me later, because I have to think then. They still are the order of service. It's called the order of service for Chirags. Anyway. I would be remiss if I didn't do my traditional teaching about this very point. So we need a volunteer. We'll pick Salima. Okay? Are you still Salima? No, you're probably some other names. Claire. Claire was a great saint, but she suffered too much. Be Salima, you'll be happier. So Salima decides that she's going to leave us all right now, and she's going to go to Asheville to have a beautiful dinner out with your beloved. And she gets up and says, bye, everybody, and she starts to leave. And we all go, no, Salima, don't go. Come back, Salima. No, no. She said, no, really. No, you can't go. Oh, I'll be miserable if you go. How could you leave me? All of us crying and wailing and screaming and gnashing our teeth. And she really wants to go, but she loves us and she feels our pain and our confusion. What does she do? What do you do? Well, you stop. You think, well, maybe I shouldn't go. Maybe I should just stay. If they're really going to be in that much pain, maybe I can help them. This is what happens. When someone dies, it is our duty to help them leave, to let them leave, to let them go in the right direction, not to call them back. It's not natural, even though, as I said, we're guilty if we don't have the moaning and the wailing and the weeping.
When you see these images in the newspaper of a parent weeping, that's really hurting the person that they're weeping for.
Yeah, well, that's a difficult question. I've been at a bombing in Israel. And the energy is indescribable. To have that much maturity to not do that is almost unimaginable. But that's the ideal. Yes, that's the ideal. There is a story, a Sufi story, a true story, of a sheikh who had seven sons. Great sheikh, real person. He had seven sons, and they were beautiful sons and wonderfully good boys, you know, when they were young men. And then he had a daughter. And this daughter was the light of his life. And he was an older man, and she would go with him everywhere, and he would teach. He had hundreds of students, and she would sit in his lap. And she stayed there until she was like seven, eight, nine, and she was always with him. And he used to call her my soul. And one day, she died in an accident. And he was teaching the class, and everybody was afraid to tell him. And finally, one of his students came in and said, "Murshid, your daughter died in an accident." He stopped the class. He said the prayer from the Quran that you say when someone dies. And he said, "Now never mention her name to me again." And he went on with his class. All of his students thought he was the cruelest, coldest, meanest person. And they were ready to leave him. And finally, one of them said, "How could you? You know, why did you?" He said, "Because I love her." So maybe it is possible. I don't know. I couldn't do it. I don't think I could do it, let's say that. I will say something since you brought up the bombing. I'd never experienced any energy like that before and never since, as that moment when everything became still. There was the noise, the light, and everything became still. And it remained that way for hours. And you could feel the transition. I hope none of us ever have to go through that in any way, shape, or form. It's another one of those unique energies. And so maybe we can do it. I don't know. It's very, very peaceful in a very strange way. Anyway, let's talk about more situations that we will probably encounter. If the death is in the hospital, many, many medical practitioners fear death. They're very afraid of it. There are many doctors who I've spoken to, and they say, "Well, when somebody dies, I view it as a failure." And that confusion is around the soul. The soul begins to leave. It sees its body quite clearly. And it knows it's going in this direction. And it sees these people, and they're all full of fear, and there are people running around, and let's try this. And it doesn't make sense because the mind has already made the shift to the other world, the other reality. So we need to train these people how to be with someone when they die. Now, that doesn't mean if the body stops having the vital signs, that they shouldn't do what they need to do to bring it back. Great. That's not what I'm talking about. But when someone is dead, when they're really dead, we need to let them go and not create confusion. It's like swirls of energy that create confusion. Again, in the departed spirit, which way do I go? What's going on? What are they so upset about? You don't become some formless glob, frankly. You have the same form you're in when you die. You don't become a 21-year-old, unless, Shibley, how old are you? Yeah, you'll stick around, though. So you better hear this, too. You're not going to be 20 again. So you keep this form, but you don't have disease. And you don't have the weight, the burden, psychological and physical burden. Unfortunately, you begin to create a world from the emotional burdens. That's the very world you create, unless you're prepared to let them go. That's the challenge we're going to talk about, but I think you all need 5 minutes to stretch or something. Are there any bathrooms here? Anybody? Am I on? Yeah. So we have a half an hour. Which is really not very much time. And I want to leave the last 20 minutes for questions, because people have questions. There was one question that came up on the break in three different ways, so I'll answer that as best I can now. Whatever belief, whatever faith people have, don't try and change it. Let them have whatever they believe. Don't even if it's the most fundamentalist or narrow or whatever it is, don't try and change it at that point. Because that will be a world that they will create that at least is familiar. Otherwise, there's no orientation whatsoever. In order to change someone's faith, assuming you can, there's a stage where you must go through doubt, because you don't change something unless you doubt it. And you don't want to take the chance, frankly, of creating doubt and perhaps having them die in doubt and confusion. So it's not our job to make people believe what we believe, because who knows if what we believe is correct anyway. But what we can do, as I was telling you, we can create a spiritual atmosphere. We can create a non-judgmental presence, lightness, love. I've been with people who either died or were dying who believed things that in a sense are terrible. But I just agreed with them and supported them, because there was no point at that point of creating conflict, that's for sure. And I hoped that through my inner prayer and concentration, the right direction would occur. You know, death is not like some game that we can all have work the way we want it to. You were just telling me about the death of your father. Do you mind if I tell that story? Where everybody was ready. Her father was dying. It was the death rattle. It was the moment of death. And her mother gave the permission and said, yes, you can leave. And then her father didn't die. And he just chose not to die then, you know, it wasn't his time. So he died the next day when he felt like dying. We don't, you know, sometimes we read these books and you think, okay, A, B, C, D, it doesn't work that way. There are many people who will not die in the presence of their relatives anyway. They won't. They want to be alone. There are many people who will only die when somebody comes. They'll live. You can't believe that they're living, but they're living until they're child comes or something like that. So there's not certain rules of death, that things must be this and must be this. We know our death. We know the way. We'll find what we need. So don't worry if it doesn't seem to go by the book. You know.
So you mentioned not to try to change people's beliefs. My father is quite elderly and he believes nothing. he believes that it will be likeness after he dies. He's reconciled to that.
Yes.
So I wonder if there's anything I could tell him so that he won't be too shy.
Well, I think from my experience that he won't be too shocked. He'll be quite happy. You know, all of China basically believes that too, because that was part of the change that came in with Mao. Oh yeah, he said his father basically believes that after death there's nothing. It's a blank. It's an empty.
Create a blank?
No, because there is no such thing as belief in a blank. And we create that which we believe unless we go beyond belief. So he will find himself in a world of his dreams. Does he dream?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He will find himself in a world like that. Will it be confusing? A little bit at first. It'll be quite disorienting because he'll expect one thing and experience another. This is not new. You all know who Hazrat Ali was, the son-in-law and the nephew of the Prophet Muhammad. And he was a great teacher. He was really the bridge that Sufism took between the Prophet and the rest of the future. And even then, there were many people who didn't believe in the afterlife. And Ali said, look, maybe you're right. But if you believe what I believe, and it turns out to be nothing, you've really lost nothing. He said, but if I believe what you believe, and it turns out to be something, I've lost everything. Everything being the opportunity to prepare. So yes, your father is not going to have the opportunity to prepare. But it is imperative to remember, all of us, that it only takes one breath to prepare. It's not like you need 50 years. If you're awake in that last breath, which can happen, depending upon many factors, if you're awake during that one breath, I don't mean awake with your eyes open, but the spirit is awakened, it's enough. You can change everything in a breath. You read all these phrases and they always start, in the name of God, most merciful, most compassionate. Sure.
How about heaven and hell?
Oh, yes. Oh, you know what? I got your thought, and I thought, oh, well, I haven't said anything about heaven and hell, and maybe I can get away with it. I actually was just thinking that.
But you said something about heaven.
Yes, I did. I did say something about heaven. Um, So let's talk about hell. And I think the easiest way to do this is by example. Imagine that there is someone who's a terrible criminal, whatever crime you want to pick, it doesn't matter. But very proficient at their crime, their chosen crime. And they never get caught. And they go through life committing this crime over and over and over again. And they never get caught. And they become very rich, and they become very successful in life, and they're leading the good life, and they've kind of numbed that part of their conscience, and they live their life, and they die a nice old age, you know, with a smile on their lips, in a sense. And then they go after death, and they create a world, just like everybody else, of whatever impressions are unfinished. And in them, the most powerful impressions, the ones that it has taken all of this energy to suppress, will be the energy of their crime, whatever it is. So now they have this one impression, which is their crime, that the energy of which is released. But after death, our willpower is very different than here. You know, many of you have had dreams where something terrible is about to occur, and you think, oh, if only I could move my left leg and walk away, it wouldn't happen, but I can't move. And you think, well, what's going on here? Here, you'd have enough energy at least to walk out of the way. There, you can't move. You don't have the power to do it. Well, in the same way, this person does not have the power to repress this impression anymore. And so it comes out. And it comes out in everything over and over again. Because that impression has a tremendous amount of energy in it. And that person lives in a world that is made up of that crime. That becomes the focus of their world. I'll tell you Murshid Sam's favorite heaven and hell story. Simple story. One of the German generals from World War II dies and awakens in this beautiful little German village. Looks around and is just overwhelmed. Beautiful little shops in a village green and happy people walking around. And in the middle of the village green, the general sees Hitler. And he's sitting there going, oh God, oh this is terrible. I can't stand the pain anymore. And moaning and groaning and wailing. The general walks up to Hitler and he said, Mein Führer, what's wrong with you? This doesn't seem so bad. And Hitler looks at him and he says, doesn't seem so bad. This is hell. And he goes, well, it doesn't look so bad. And Hitler goes, Jews, Jews, Jews. The general said, I don't understand. What's the matter? He said, look at the stores. And the general looks at the stores and it's Schwartz Brothers Bakery and Cohn the Tailor and Ginsburg Food Store and on and on. And Hitler goes, I'm in the heaven of the Jews and it's hell for me. The general said, well, this is heaven. All you have to do is stop thinking about Jews. And Hitler said, yes, you see, it's hell. So that story, to me, best explains hell. The Buddha said it a different way. And he said it as he was dying. He said, as a thing is viewed, so it appears. Murshid and Hazrat Inayat Khan said it a different way. I went to hell and saw there love's raging fire. Now I'll tell you another story which happened a few weeks ago. Also to help explain hell, I was having a 5-day seminar on death and dying, which I'm going to do again in the fall. I'm going to do it every year now in Florida. Sarasota, Florida. So I had the seminar and I thought, you know, as part of this seminar, I have to take the participants into hell. It's just not fair to do it otherwise. So we did certain practices together and we went into the underworlds. The complete underworlds with demons and beings in agony and everything. And we came out of this meditation, and I had never done this with other people before. I'd done it with myself as part of training, but I never did it with anybody else. And we came out of this meditation. It was a long meditation. We were sitting in a circle, and I think there were, I forget what the limit was, maybe 20 people. And after a few minutes of silence, I said, so, how was that? First person said, you know, it wasn't so bad. Everybody's kind of shocked except the second person who said, I had the same experience. I could feel it, I could feel the agony, but it wasn't so bad. And then people began to open up and share that they were having similar experiences. And everybody was very confused. And I said, let's just sit with it for a day and see what happens. Later on that day, I was walking on the beach with a dear friend, someone I love dearly, who is a great teacher, one of the hidden teachers. So I told her about this experience, and she laughed and she said, you know, none of you were in hell. And I looked at her and I said, what do you mean? She said, all of you still had God. So maybe I should say hell is the absence of that. When the wall becomes so thick that the light can't shine through, and you're there chipping away at the wall with a teaspoon. It is important to know that the bodhisattvic beings, these saints who will not move on until all feeling beings have gone before them, are most easily found in hell. They, you know, where was Jesus? Was he found with the angels? Was he found with the holy people? No, he was with the tax collectors and the prostitutes. He was with the people who needed him. Where are the bodhisattvas? They're with the ones who need them. So, I don't know what you believe you've done in life, but I don't think you're going to have to worry too much about hell as a purification, which it is. It releases these impressions. It requires a tremendous amount of fire to release some of these impressions that have taken so much energy to keep down. But you might find yourself in hell helping. because some of you have pretty beautiful hearts that just, your hearts go out to suffering. And if so, you'll suffer along with those who suffer, because you can't be there and not suffer. But you'll know enough. You'll know enough.
Will we still have God with us if we go there tonight?
Yes, you'll still have God with you because you can't get rid of God.
So it will make it
different. Your experience will be different. As I said, we experienced what people experienced, but our viewpoint of it was different. What is, do you remember, I think it was Dante, at over the doorway of hell said, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." And what does that mean? Abandon God, all ye who enter here. Hope is God. So, yes. You know, I can't hear you.
Even at the moment of the exit of breath,
right,
and the moment of burial and resurrection,
yes,
like somebody said, that the day and maybe that was a near death experience.
Yes.
Actually come back from the tunnel.
Yes.
Or like I read another story where someone actually made a coma and was dead, physically dead.
Yes. Well, there, you know, as I said, there are different viewpoints. There are no absolutes. The Hindus and the Jews and the Muslims believe that the body should be put in the ground or in the fire as quickly as possible. For many reasons. Not the least of which is it's the least painful for the family. The impression of the body being there is not necessarily helpful. On the other hand, this idea that the body should be rushed away as soon as it dies is also not helpful. There is a period of time to say goodbye. And that could be anywhere from a few hours to longer. It's very helpful if each of us envision our own death and think of what we'd like to have done. Because each of us represent our own unique being. And, you know, my wife said, "Well, what do you want?" And I said, "Well, ideally, I like the Zoroastrian way. If you could put me in a tree and let the birds just come and eat me, I'd be totally happy." And she said, "Well, forget it." I said, okay. let me just finish. No, don't apologize. You didn't do anything. So I don't know the answer. I used to think I knew the answer, but now I really don't know. But please have the freedom, if you are still alive, to use your God-given intuition, and you'll know what to do. If a body is going to come back after a day and a half, and you're with the body after 10 minutes, if you can just be quiet, be still, and know that I am, as it says in the book, you'll find out, you'll know what to do. You'll say, no, we cannot bury this person yet. We have to wait 2 days. You'll know. On the other hand, maybe you'll know after an hour, that's enough now. We have to wash the body and put it in the ground or put it in the fire or whatever. It is, your attitude is so important, because even though that spirit is leaving, they're pretty close still. And they will direct you as to what they want. I have a very dear friend, and her husband died, and she was there at the death, and she stayed. She didn't tell anybody, and just stayed in his room and danced for 3 hours. She's a great dancer. She danced for 3 hours. At the end of the dance, she called and said, "Okay, now, you know." There are certain things that I wish we did. I wish we washed the body. And in Hinduism they use butter, and in other religions they use oil, but it is wonderful to anoint the body before burial with some kind of fat. You know, in if you cook, the element of food that conveys the most flavor is the fat. And the element that gives the most protection to the skin and keeps it soft is the fat. And when the prophets were anointed, they were anointed with the fat. Oil is just fat, that's all it is. The fat represents a certain aspect of creation, a richness and light. You know, you can't get much light from broccoli, but you get a lot from olive oil. Yes. So.
Do you have any comments on the way that we in the Western world formalize or put formaldehyde into bodies?
Yes, I can't stand it. I have a Mareed. Oh, good for you. Good for you. I have a Mareed. Because it's a violation. And it's absurd. I mean, we have this, there's no reason for it whatsoever. And we've bought into this, I hope nobody's an undertaker, but we've bought into this nonsense that's really put out by people who make a profit from putting formaldehyde into bodies. And we bought the whole thing because we're afraid of death and because we're afraid to deal with dead bodies.
But it actually prevents the deterioration of
the body. Yeah, yeah.
And does that in any way impede the loosening of the ties with the physical?
Let's just say that it's not necessary. It's not beautiful. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't death be beautiful? Life is. Mm-hmm. So, really, I have this Mareed. I can give you her email address if I look it up. She started this thing in Texas that's now, I think, nationwide of I forget what they call it, but it's basically taking back the power to deal with the dead bodies themselves. And there are instructions now online how to prepare the body, how to get the certificate, how to bury the body, how to find places that will let you do it. There's this whole movement that's beginning now.
The auditorium was packed, and she is the one who goes into different stages. With death being there, or how the family feels. So she said, I think it's very important that I tell all of you, you know, about this, and then you can read about it. She said, because I can only help so many, and I'll still be here when you're all gone.
Yeah. Well, really, the meat of that is true. We have to be the teachers. You can't sit here and just be the learners. You have to be the teachers. You know, I do this wherever I can, wherever it's feasible, and maybe in a whole year I'll talk to 200 people. Maybe. Because this doesn't seem to work in huge halls and so on for some reason. It works when it's a group like this. Works best. So you have to take it, let it sink in and swirl around and give it out. Again, I urge you, read two things. Read The Soul's Journey, that book I had yesterday, and also in the Sufi message of Inayat Khan, read Aqibat, Life After Death. That's what it's called, Aqibat, Aqibat.
Five.
I don't know.
When you're not able to be present, you may be thousands of miles
yes.
away, but you've been preparing, like in my case, you know, I already was present when a beloved passed, and you confirmed that I did almost everything, even though till this day, many years passed, and people
think that I was just a cold bastard. Really what I think. When you're not able to be physically present and you are afraid and don't know the exact time, you might get the call that they passed away. What should you do?
You should make believe that every moment is the exact time. Keep them on your consciousness as best you can. Now that might be something as simple as taking a picture and just keeping it in your room or something like that. But in the mind is best. And when I say every moment, I don't know if we have that kind of concentration. But keep them in your consciousness often. Think about them. No, he's talking about before. If you don't know the moment, if you can't be there, think about them. And then and you'll... Sometimes you can be actually a greater help by being at a distance than being there. So, trust in the perfection of the universe. Yeah. Now I want to stop soon. No, that's okay. It totally. But there's a difference between praying for them and calling them back. Pray for people after they've gone, absolutely. You know, in Judaism, they go twice a day for a year. In Islam, it's slightly different. In Hinduism, there's the anniversary. You keep celebrating, you keep praying for it. Not just yearly, by the way, monthly and weekly initially. And in Buddhism, I think they do the same as Hinduism, but of course pray for the dead. They can get great solace and energy from our prayers. But don't call them back.
Don't we do that every time we say, blessings be upon Muhammad?
Yeah.
Isn't that like praying for
it? Yes, sure. And
I
so...
Say that in every sentence.
Say... When you leave, I'm going to say, peace and blessings be upon Rabia. But I'm not even going to wait. I'll say it now. Yes. In any way that you can, in any way that you can habitualize prayer, do it. Do it. Only good can come of it.
I was curious. You said that people can have an obsession. Is that different than possession?
No.
Okay, so you meant it that same way.
Yes.
Okay.
The only thing that we don't realize is we can be a host, so to speak, to many beings, not just one. So we can be possessed by a whole host of beings. Mm-hmm. And why do people possess us? Why do people possess, why do beings, I should say, possess other people on earth? Well, they can experience life on earth except through a being with physical senses. They're here. I mean, this room today is full of unseen beings who are here because they get energy from this. But why are they here? Because they too want to go in the right direction. Even those beings who are obsessing us are obsessing us so that we can say, go, go. They're just confused. Thank you, I think it's enough. So